Today, Elections and Consequences, the sequel.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
By which, of course, I only mean part two of the conversation. Last time what we talked about were the elections that I've experienced in my life and what I've learned from them, just a few things that have emerged from seeing them. And the reason I introduced all of that was because I want to get to the point of being able to say what I've learned about people and how we think about public policy that should get us through some of the, on one side, angst, anxiety, fear, panic, crisis moment that we have a sense of on one side, and on the other side, a sense of withdrawal, vacating the premises, giving up hope, turning off the news, refusing to watch what's going on, while on both ends of that spectrum, the others are celebrating the final recovery of society to what we needed it to be so that we could survive and grow and thrive and become, all those positive things, and others that are just having a party now because everything's good now. I've been around long enough that I know none of that's the case. It's not the case that we're now facing the apocalypse, and it's not the case that we now have the end of all bad things and life can become the way it was supposed to be. And I know I'm being slightly hyperbolic to where both ends of that spectrum are. There are a few people actually there, but I know most of us are somewhere in between. But I also know after so many decades of watching these elections that there are better things that we could learn about how we should see what's actually happening, and then how we could think about not just the results of this election, but what the next election might mean. And beyond that, what we're supposed to understand about how we live with each other. And so I wanted to take that in two or three steps today, and then we'll be done with this conversation following, the election from a month ago or whatever. And, part of this, I hope also, by the way, since I think this episode should come out the week of Thanksgiving, when you're actually about to celebrate with your family, probably tomorrow, if you're listening to it as it comes out. And this, I hope, will give you a reason to remember that there's always more to give thanks for. Even in the people we most disagree with, there is plenty to give thanks for. So anyway, the first step today, after last time having talked about, Plato and even using some references from the Gospels to talk about the fact that people are not the measure of all things, that we should not come to the conclusion that because someone has won an election that they must be right, or because someone loses an election that they must be wrong. They're not as good at elections if they lose the election, but that may simply be because they weren't willing to compromise a value that was actually something we ought to agree with. That's possible on both sides. So if that's the case and people are not the measure of all things, then do we just disregard, the people who are involved in the process? Well, obviously not. It's all about the people. How do we come together as a society to function? So what I want to do first is just remind us about something regarding people. What we ought, I think, probably first to remember about people if we're going to come together and function well as a society. And when I say well, I just mean understand why it's so important and valuable to be with and around people in a social contract that engages others where we might not want to be, but where we know we ought to be. So why would we bother doing that? So first step is to recognize that most of us And this is, I'll use scripture to make the point, but I'll also demonstrate with some political stuff. Most of us are dominated by fear. That's what governs our lives. I wish we weren't that way. We try as we get more and more mature. I hope we learn not to be as much that way. But it still is the way we are. And the author of Hebrews doesn't make any bones about it. I mean, this is the quotation, famous quotation from Hebrews 2:14. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, talking about Christ, it comes on to say, he himself, Christ, likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, you know, the devil. Verse 15 then says, and deliver all those who through fear of death we're subject to lifelong slavery. We're constantly compelled by death. And, you know, I hear it, the way I think about it, and I'm saying that as a man, seems to be different than the way a lot of women think about it. So you wouldn't follow the same path. I can't go down the path women go down to get there. I don't know what's going on in those minds. Good for them. But I know in my mind what's going on. Because, you know, I think a lot of other men think this way, at least all the men I've ever spoken with seem to think this way, which is catastrophically, you know, oh, well, you know, what's going to happen is I'm going to fail this class and then I'm not going to be able to get a job and then I'm going to get kicked out of my house and then I'm not going to have a place to live and then I'm going to starve to death and I'm going to die. Or after they have a family and they're an adult, it's like, I'm going to go and I'm going to fail on this task and the boss is going to fire me, and then I'm going to go home and tell my wife I don't have a job, and we'll do our best for a few weeks, but then we'll run out of money, and then we'll run out of food, and then our kids will die, and then we'll die, and everybody's going to die. We're very catastrophic in our way of thinking about conclusions, and that's, you know, our fear. And our fear always is somehow, obliquely at least, connected to dying. You know, we're going to die. Oh, it's going to die. You know, everything's terrible. So I say that, and again, I know it's hyperbolic because hopefully as we get older, as we mature, we stop being quite as afraid of the same things, and we learn over time how to manage our pressure, the tension a little greater, a little better. But there is still that fear there, and Hebrews 2:15 doesn't mince words about it. It's part of who we are. And in practical terms, that shows up in the way we play our politics. And I'm saying play not because it's trivial, but because it is juvenile. And it's embarrassing, right? The way we use fear and people's fears to motivate action in the election, because nothing will get people to the polls better than a little fear-mongering, you know? So I remember back in the, I can't remember for sure which election it was, but if I remember correctly, it was 1988, when George H.W. Bush was running and ended up because of some advisors he had, and they created this ad, which came to be known as the Willie Horton ad. It was the revolving door out of prison ad. And people my age all remember it because it was profoundly influential, and you couldn't turn around without seeing it on someone's television. And, you know, it was a revolving door at the exit to a prison. It was people walking in and then just turning around and walking right back out because of some program of releasing prisoners for weekends and stuff like that, that it ended up with a prisoner legitimately getting out and going and killing somebody, doing something terrible as a result of it. There's a whole story behind it. I don't remember the whole story. I could probably remember some of it. But the point is, it didn't matter whether that had happened once or 1,000 times, and it happened once. It didn't matter whether it was already addressed in how those policies would be enforced going forward. All that mattered was you were able to put into people's minds the image of a criminal just walking out of prison to go commit whatever other crimes he wanted to commit, because those terrible Democrats are going to let everybody out, right? So what you're doing is just creating fear. It was made worse by putting the image of a black man walking out of the prison. That was not an accident. Nobody thinks that was an accident. So it became not just fear-mongering, but using race to promote fear, which is, you know, very much the same kind of thing that goes on now. That isn't, it's not politically foolish to do that. It works because people are motivated by fear. They don't want their neighborhoods to be overrun by gangs. They don't want criminality to destroy the fabric of society. They want their kids to be safe in their own neighborhoods and so on. Of course they want that. And they're afraid they won't have it. So if you can show them some image that makes them feel like you might care more about their fears than the other person, you know, it's a political advantage. I get that. Does that make it right? No, I find it unethical and horrendous as a thing to do, but it is what goes on in politics. This cycle, if you looked on one side of the political spectrum, you saw constant transgender athletic ads. They want these big, mean men to play sports with our little girls and keep them unsafe. And it's just, it's a fear-mongering tactic. Does it mean it would never happen? No, it doesn't mean that. Am I saying there's no reason to have a concern about that issue? No, I'm not even saying that. But the fear-mongering was just embarrassing. Nobody wants what they were describing, and yet they were describing it as if it was the only thing that was going on. The same thing on the other side. These women are being denied medical care. So again, does that ever happen? Yeah, it does. Nobody doubts that those stories are real and that they have real significance. Is that really the thing that should shape our policy for millions of people, that we have these exceptional cases? Now, again, I'm not even having that debate, not having it about the transgender issue, not having it about the abortion issue and the laws in the state of Texas with the abortion issue. But, you know, the state of Texas is not going to elect Donald Trump as its governor. It was a presidential election, not even a state election. And we're talking about state laws and how the election is going to affect them in order to get a president elected or a senator who's in the United States Senate, not the Texas Senate or legislature, because we're playing off of fear. Look, this is terrible. Look what they're going to do to our daughters. Or, and isn't it funny? On both of those ads, funny. Anyway, that in both of those ads, it is, look what they're going to do to our little girls. They're going to put transgender athletes on the field with our little girls. They're going to take away your little girl's right to medical care. It's all about being able to promote some fear and play off of legitimate fears that people have. You can have an intelligent, meaningful conversation about either of those topics without playing off of the fear, but you wouldn't win the election because fear motivates people. Most of us are just pragmatic when it comes to politics. We just want whatever's going to bring about the best results for us in the end. That's what we want. On the fringes, and we know this, everybody's kind of aware of this, except the people who are on the fringes. I think they think they're normal. They can be turned out by values. You know, they've got these core values either on either side, on the far right and on the far left. You got people who are going to shed. They believe the entire universe hinges on the decision of this election and this specific topic and whether there's this solution or that solution. They're going to show up and vote no matter what. They're going to turn up no matter what. Most voters, they're dominated by a self-interest. That's their concern. What's going to help me? What's going to make my life easier? What's going to help my family? And I don't mean by that that they're entirely selfish. Those are two different ideas. They're not unrelated, but they are different ideas. The need to survive, for instance, is pure self-interest. It is not selfish, because when we use the word selfish, we normally imply by it something a little malicious. Like, he doesn't even care about other people. He just cares about himself. You know, there is always present a self-interest for a person. I've done episodes where we talked about that it's always present, but it doesn't have to be sufficient to explain every behavior. So there could be legitimate altruism too. The self-interest is still going to be there. Now, I'm not concerned about the philosophical side of that. I just want to make this point. When it comes to an election, why do you think economics is so important to people? Because they're all so intellectually curious about economic models. You know, I'm not sure. Do I follow the Austrian model, or is it something where I prefer? Nobody's saying that. That the concern is, well, look at the price of eggs. Look how expensive it is for me to buy a gallon of milk now. What am I supposed to do about that? Let's throw out the old bum and get a new one. And then in 4 years, we'll throw out that bum if the prices haven't gotten better. It's not complicated. People want their lives to be better. And I'm going to make a stronger case for why we should be okay with that model of people making their decisions. Not that I want to make my decisions that way. I'm not saying that. But I am saying we shouldn't be surprised by it, and we should probably appreciate the value of that model of doing elections and having an electorate that is self-interested more than we do right now. So this is why that would be the case. You just think about the premise of a representative democracy. The premise of a representative democracy is not, this is a representative democracy. Direct democracy, different thing. Get everybody in a stadium and have a vote, or require every single person to serve on the town council in rotation. And, you know, you serve 6 months at a time, and then it's the next guy's turn, and it's the guy who lives next door to you. It's his turn, so he's going to go serve. Direct democracy, different thing. There, you need everybody to be educated. You need everyone to understand how societies work and how you're solving problems and to keep up with the news cycle and blah, blah, blah. That's not the premise of a representative democracy. The whole point in representative democracy is a lot of these people are not going to be able to make a good decision about what our society should be like. They may make such a literally, and I mean this, the word selfish decision that it would be harmful to other people in the society. So what we need is for them to be able to elect representatives who can make better decisions. That's the whole point. So get some people who are able to do that. So the premise of a representative democracy, and I'm just saying this from me, this is what I've learned over the years, right? It's not an intelligent, educated, capable population. But there is a goal, and it is about the population. It is that there is a self-interested population that is also free. And it can't just be coincidentally that they're free. They have to value freedom. That's why when our Constitution is written and we work through all the process, we're going to have these three branches of government, and they're going to have the checks and balances, and we're going to restrict this to that age and this to that power, and you know, all the, it's going to be like that. So everything's made. Then you say, we've got this mechanism for building a giant, powerful structure to give governance to the society. What's going to rein it in? Because we don't want just a powerful government. What we want are free citizens. That's why we left where we were. So how do we get to free citizens? Well, let's create some amendments, and we'll add those as the Bill of Rights. And all of the first 10 amendments are about protecting the individuals in our society from the authority that monstrosity of government is going to have inherently, because it's always bigger than the individual. And so, you know, when you're looking at the First Amendment for free religion, speech, press, assembly, the right to protest, to do all of that, the Second Amendment, to bear arms, and I get you can have all kinds of arguments about it. I'm in favor of a lot of gun control, a lot more than we have now. I think it's completely irresponsible not to do something more serious than we've done. I don't know exactly what it is, and it's very complicated to get there, because I know that as you read the Second Amendment, if you just take a casual amount of logic and apply it to it, it's about individuals being able to have guns. It's about individuals having the right to bear arms. Because you don't put an amendment so that a militia can have arms into the Second Amendment when militias already have arms. The point is, you can store all the arms you want in some, you know, armory and then give them out to people, but that's under the authority of the government. And the whole point in this Bill of Rights is that the people should be able to protect themselves from a government that would overreach, that would go too far. So we don't want the government to infringe on speech, press, assembly, you know, your right to protest, the religion that you want to choose. And it'll help if people have access to arms to do that. Again, I'm not here ranting and raving about one direction or the other with arms. I'm just saying the Constitution is written, the Bill of Rights added to it, to make the point that we really want a free population. We want individuals to care about their own freedom. The fact that we put that in the Second Amendment is a statement about how important it is that this population have a self-interest in preserving their freedom. By the time you get to the Third Amendment and following, it's really a statement. We don't want the government going into people's houses when they don't want them in there. We don't want them to be able to arrest people, to take their property, to search for things without getting due process along the way. And the same thing with the entire criminal justice system. Nothing without due process by the time you get to the Fifth Amendment, all the way through the first 10 amendments, even the limitations at the end that say if it's not given explicitly to the federal government, then it reverts to the states. All of that is to say we want the government limited so that the freedom of individuals can be preserved. That's the point of the organization of our society. What I'm saying is, and this is half of the game today, and then I can make the point of why this would be important to us. All I'm saying is that when people are voting, and what they're voting on is their own, preserving their own freedom, that's not a bad thing for the way this society was designed. The way this society is designed is to say, we want you to be able to choose your own goals, your own ends. We don't want to say from on high, this is what you should care about. We, and this goes all the way back to that period of time at the end of the 18th century, into the beginning of the 19th century, when we were trying to figure out what would make societies stronger. We value the variety of opinions that people have, and we want them to be able to preserve that variety. Some of them are inevitably going to come to a loggerheads. It's inevitable. You can't have every possible different way of being a human being come together into one society. There are going to be some conflicts that are present. So you have to make some public policies that rule some things in and some things out. But if everybody's getting to say, here's how I think we can preserve the most freedom, then we are going to do well as a society. Here's how we're going to preserve his right to do what he wants to do and my right to do what I want to do, and nobody's impinged on. And if you wonder, why on earth would I care about that other guy's right to freedom? It's because we all know, after very little experience, we all know that if we aggrandize the power to take away someone's freedom, even to ourselves with some other people, we will eventually be in the group that gets excluded from the freedom where everybody teams up against us, because all of us know over time that the whole is inherently more powerful than the individual, piece. So here's where things go wrong. And this is what I need us to acknowledge about ourselves if I'm going to communicate anything that I mean to communicate today. What we need to acknowledge about ourselves is our tendency toward hypocrisy. And I mean by this, by hypocrisy, our tendency to ascribe to ourselves some value that we don't give to others, or to ascribe some accusation to others that we're willing to overlook in ourselves. And we avoid exactly what, you know, Matthew 7 is teaching, which I've talked about on different episodes quite a bit, so I won't go through the whole thing today, but the, you know, judge not lest you be judged with whatever judgment you judge, you yourselves will also be judged. And then saying the same thing with standards, with whatever measure you meet, it will also be measured out to you. All of those statements are saying you can't have one standard for yourself and a different standard for everyone else. So when I say, you know, we have a tendency to be hypocritical, we practice hypocrisy in our judgment against others, I mean, in a lot of ways, what we tend to do is say, well, as long as I'm getting to do what I want to do, as long as that freedom is preserved, I don't care if their freedom's preserved. That doesn't work. Your freedom's not being preserved when you do that. Your choice is being preserved. Your one choice is being preserved, but not freedom. There's no preservation of freedom if it's not reserved for everyone we can possibly save it for. We're trying to maximize everyone's freedom when we have these democratic, and again, it's representative democracy, but it is a democratic process in election. It's saying, let's hear from everyone else what they think will preserve their freedom, and hopefully from the ones who are mature, what they think will maximize freedom for everyone in the process. And so the way we mess up in our hypocrisy isn't just that we say, well, I want to be free, but I don't really care if anybody else is free, not without recognizing that that's an empty statement. Because again, that's not about freedom. That's about being powerful. The question about freedom is different than that. The way I think that error shows up when we start thinking, well, I'm just trying to be free. I'm just trying to do the right thing for our country. And those guys over there, those guys are terrible. The way that shows up is when we start ascribing motives to other people for why they're doing what they're doing, which is not what they say. Now, it's true that some people have ulterior motives, and it's true that sometimes we might even be able to figure those out. That's not what's going on in these elections. I'm watching, people are ascribing motives purely on the basis of what will drive the most fear into whichever base they're on, left or right, so that they can get the vote out to get rid of those terrible right-wing whatevers, or to get rid of those terrible left-wing whatevers. And ascribing motives is hypocritical. You don't want people telling you why you're doing things when you've told them, this is why I do it. I'm doing it for this reason. If someone then says to you, well, you know, the real reason he's doing that is because he's not even a patriot. He doesn't even care about his country. You know that that's not a fair thing to say about you. So why would we assume it's a fair thing for us to say about them? So look, let's consider this. I'll give you just two examples. Number one, and these are glaring examples during this last election season. Number one is I heard lots of people criticizing the candidates who are on the right and on the left. I can think of our Senate election, you know. In that election, there were people who were saying, well, he only says those things because he wants to make this crowd happy, or he only says those things because he's trying to make his left-wing crowd happy. Whoever it is, they would say it about both sides of these candidates. He holds that position in order to make the culture happy. And then we would say, well, what a terrible thing. What a weak thing to do. And so what you're doing in that is, and I think there's some value in thinking this way, you're condemning cultural conformity. Well, if you just do what everybody's doing, what kind of leader are you? You know, take a stand, believe in something. Don't just cooperate with the culture. Sometimes the culture's wrong and you need to go a different direction than that. I understand that. That makes perfect sense. Saying about someone, oh, he's just doing that to make the culture happy. Here's the problem. When right after this, we ascribe to whoever wins the election the idea that their win proves that they were right. And I'm telling you, I know a lot of times we use this ubiquitous you or they category of whoever it is to lump people together who aren't saying the same thing. But if I'm lying, I'm dying, man. I'm looking in social media and the very same people who in one breath were criticizing the opponent candidate for giving into the culture were after the election celebrating righteous victory because the election proves that we were right because we won the election. Now, remind me exactly who voted in the election. I'm pretty sure it's the culture that voted in the election. So exactly who got the culture behind them? And what does that tell you about who was pleasing the culture? Now, it's not my point that one side was right, one side was wrong. It's my point that we're being hypocritical in the things we're saying in accusing people of having a certain motive to make culture happy, only really to use that to our own advantage and then ignore it when we turn around and say, see, the culture supports us, so we must be right. The hypocrisy is overlooking the fact that winning an election, you know, is the ultimate evidence of cultural conformity. That's how you win an election. Get more people to like what you're saying and doing. We shouldn't condemn cultural conformity and then celebrate the evidence of cultural conformity. Nor should we think that winning an election is evidence that whatever it is we're promoting is right. You might be glad you won, and what you promote might be right. But it's not proof of it because you win the election. That just means more people supported you in that moment. And by the way, neither should we condemn something as wrong simply because the culture values it. Sometimes the culture is valuing really important and good things, and we ought to listen to them and learn from them what's going on. The value that's involved, the ethical issue that's involved, the social, political, moral, whatever issue that's involved has a value in and of itself, regardless of how many people support it or don't support it. We should recognize that. Otherwise, we're very likely to fall into that category of just using it as a tool during the election cycle or for other political reasons and becoming hypocrites. And another example of being hypocrites by ascribing motives to people, right? So ascribing a cause to why people are doing something or a motive to why they're doing it, which is not what they say about why they're doing it, would be this. When we say, you know, people who vote for X, some absurd policy, some policy we hate. So on one side, transgenderism. On the other side, you know what I mean, promoting transgender participation in athletics, blah, blah, blah. On the one side, oh, such an absurd policy. Who could ever support that when we're saying that? Or on the other side, when they were saying, who could support these absolute restrictions on abortion where you can't even get one for incest or for, you know, rape of or, you know, any or health of the mother or anything. You can't get one at all. These absurd policies, who would do that? They must be. And then here's, and this is a criticism that I heard. People wouldn't say this outright in ads, but they said it plenty on social media and in person. They must be, I'll put it politely, intellectually obtuse, right? Not the sharpest tack in the, where do you keep tacks? In the drawer? I don't know. Wherever you keep tray? I don't know. Wherever tacks are. Not the sharpest, you know? You must be really ignorant. Well, what we're doing is just going back to the same thing we had before, to fear. You know, they're going to do that and it's going to destroy our society and everything's going to fall apart. And so how could they even think about voting for that without recognizing the terrible consequences that are going to come from it? They must not be thinking clearly at all. They must be just fools. Why not rather say this? It's such a weird thing. I don't know why we're incapable. I was incapable of it for decades. I'm not sure I'm good at it now. Let me rephrase that. I'm positive I'm not good at it now. But I'm trying to learn to do better at this. Why on earth can't we just say, you know, that is such a nonsensical policy to me. I wonder what on earth is motivating that person to say they would vote that way. Why would they think so differently? Instead of saying they must be too unintelligent to grasp what my superior intellect has mastered, why not say sincerely, I must be missing something, because that doesn't make any sense to me at all. Because really, and I mean, I've said this a bunch of times on the air too. In reality, people are not stupid. They're just not. It's really remarkable how intelligent every person you meet is. You have to go far and wide to find someone who has some kind of brain damage or something, to get someone who can't think through things. Most of it's just a question of interest. Are you interested in this, interested in that? And everybody's interested in something. Whatever they're interested in, you start having a conversation, you'll realize they can just leave you in the dust intellectually about that thing that they care about. And on this, people are not dumb. They understand. They just understand something different than you. This happened to me a few years back, and I mean quite a few years back, when I was having a discussion with a former, not a student in my college, but a student in my church when I was pastoring. So, you know, this has been more than 20 years ago now, obviously. I've been here at Criswell College for 20 years. So before that, I had a student in my youth college something program who then, you know, as he graduated and went on to ministry, he's a pastor up in Ohio now. Indiana. I said the wrong state. It's those states. You know, it's one of the other 49, whatever. That's a joke. I'm just being Texas arrogant in that statement. So anyway, the point is, I had a conversation with him about this reality that I had not come across it, because I don't live in the Rust Belt. He lived in the Rust Belt. You know what I mean by that? The place where the steel industry has declined and most of the plants have shut down. And so it gets referred to as the Rust Belt. You have all these facilities that are shut down. People lost their jobs. The economy collapsed. It's been a terrible environment. It's all blue collar. All these communities are very largely blue collar. And they're very largely white communities as well. Not entirely, but a lot of them are white communities. And so he was making the point to me that that I didn't understand. It's like, well, you know, why are people so offended by these questions about racism or things like that when it comes up? And he was making his point about the members of his church and the community that he was around and how that white Rust Belt population felt exhausted at being overlooked as a suffering population. Nobody cared about what was happening to them. Nobody would say there's an inherent injustice in the fact that your family gave generations, not just a few decades of one person working in a plant, but generations working in a facility. And then it's just shut down and people move on and they're like, get over it, go get a technological job, do something else. They don't realize the impact that has on these families and their communities. And they were looking for a hero, for somebody to represent them. Not knowing that made me go, why are people doing that? And then knowing that made me go, well, I can understand that. Is this the right solution? Is that the right solution? We can argue that. We can discuss that. But I can understand where they're coming from. If you're voiceless, and even when you get your voice out there, everybody just dismisses it because it's as if your concern isn't important to them, then you can understand why they're searching for something that will shake things up. It's the same thing that's happened to me in more of my denominational life, a connection with the Southern Baptist Convention historically, that, you know, I had some conversations with different women about their experiences being abused and then silenced. And until I heard them, until I sat across the table from them and heard them and their stories, I didn't grasp the gravity of what was going on with the way we relate to women in Southern Baptist life. And now I can't ignore them. You know, before I understood the jokes, people make the jokes, you know, these women, they just want it, whatever. I don't laugh at those anymore. I guarantee you that. And it's a lot worse than that. I'm not just not laughing. It's a serious issue because I realized people are not dumb. They just know things I don't. And they're involved in thinking about things in a way I haven't. Does that mean I'm going to agree with all of them? No. Does it mean I'm going to take up every one of those causes? No, it does mean I'm going to take up some of them, though. I'm going to learn something from it. And it also means I can be a lot more civil. I can be a lot more respectful. And I can improve the way I think about how I ought to be addressing those issues, about how we could improve as a society and so on. So what I want to do is, before we're done, just give a few takeaways that I think we ought to get from the discussion we've been having. So number one in the takeaways, people are trying, and again, not everybody's sincere. We know there are con artists out there. Some of them may be big time. Maybe some of the leading people we have involved are total con artists. Maybe so. But people in general, the people around you, the people who are living and building businesses, and the people who are just trying to mow their yard and raise a family or whatever, they're just trying to make the best decision they can about organizing a society where we have wildly divergent values and perspectives. And it seems important that we preserve that freedom. So people are trying to make the best judgments they can about how we preserve that. And by the way, the more we start thinking we need to get rid of those people, the more they have to start thinking, well, we need to get rid of you people. So you end up with socialists on one side and fascists on the other side, because both sides speak as if, as long as that other half is still here, we can't really have a healthy society. The problem isn't that we can't have a healthy society. The problem is we've forgotten the value of freedom. We've forgotten the importance of respecting people who completely disagree with us. And again, that doesn't mean some of those policy decisions never come to a loggerheads, like I said. It doesn't mean that. They will. There will be conflicts that have to be resolved with decisions about public policy and law and regulation and so on. I'm not denying that. But I am saying the way we make those decisions should prioritize, and I mean put first, make it prior, should prioritize the preservation of the most freedom we can preserve for everyone in the process. But we can't get there if we don't do this first, saying to ourselves, I think most people are trying to make the best decision they can about organizing a society where we have wildly divergent values and perspectives. Secondly, my second takeaway, and this one's hard to admit, but it's just true. I meet politicians. I know it sounds like, well, and I take a shower afterwards, of course. I know we want to make all the jokes. The reality is, and you think about it, would you go into politics right now? Most of us would not, because it's such a mud fest. I mean, what kind of, you know, just atrocities do you have to be willing to undergo? Abuses do you have to be willing to face on a daily basis to serve in the public sphere of politics right now? One of the things that's just true that goes hand in hand with that fact is that politicians are mostly trying to serve that end that I just mentioned of, you know, making the best decision that we can about how to organize society. Most politicians are trying to do that. Now, I know there are self-serving politicians, but even in their self-serving state, they're trying to maintain their power and keep their office and all that stuff, but trying to do that so that in the back of their mind, they can make a better society. Are they all innocent and, you know, pure as the driven snow? Of course not. I'm not pretending that. But most are trying to serve the end of making a better society. And we don't have to ascribe to them, every single politician, a motive of evil, especially simply because they disagree with us, for crying out loud. How shallow is that? Admittedly, not all politicians are trying to do the right thing. That's the truth. But I think this is inherently and observably the case, that enough of the politicians are trying to do the right thing for society to keep us from going off of a cliff just because there are a few people, politicians, who don't know their own limits, who don't understand what they don't understand, and who will use their power abusively. I think we have enough judges and senators and representatives and chief executives who will put up a hand and say, no, we're not doing that. We're not going to be that way. That we don't have to believe. So look, this is why we haven't had the apocalypse. Even though that apocalypse, I'm raising my hand and telling you, it's been predicted in every election I have witnessed since I have been a child. Our country will not be what it's ever been if you elect whatever. We will, our economy will collapse. All of freedom will cease. And I'm still going home and having a hot dog on July 4th after all those elections. It's like, what are you? And again, I'm not saying no catastrophes can come. They can. Societies can fall apart. It can happen. But we have a lot of people who sincerely desire doing the right thing in their office. And they have some power. And I think a lot of those guys want to use it, and gals obviously, want to use it to preserve our freedom. That's what I think is going on. Next, and this is the last big takeaway that I want to make, just a few little points to go with it. Believers in this setting have our best opportunity ever. Always, it's always our best opportunity because it's the one in front of us. Believers have the opportunity to demonstrate what faith means. We have the opportunity in this environment, which is so divisive with all of those other issues going on, to prove that we actually are committed to something bigger, something that's more enduring than our own political body. Yes, more enduring, heaven forbid I say it, than the United States of America. If you find that offensive, you really need to rethink your understanding of the kingdom of God. I mean, for crying out loud, are we Christians or not? We are, and so are you. So this is a great opportunity to commit, to show that we're committed to something bigger, to something more enduring than this political body. It's our opportunity to demonstrate what faith means because we can show that we entrust to God the oversight and judgment of other people. We trust God to take care of them. We trust God to oversee them. We can demonstrate our faith by illustrating that we entrust to God the meaning and influence of our own lives, because we follow this one great teaching that he gave us: to love your neighbor. To love your neighbor, which includes the one who is least like you. And that other commandment, you know, the one he gave first: to love God, even when he's not doing what you want him to do the way you want him to do it. That's what faith is all about.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.